You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 13th of May 2022 on Monocle 24.
We'll be live from Warsaw, taking the temperature of Poland's capital. And we'll be in Turin, where the city is in a froth of pre-Eurovision preparation. And we'll introduce you to Jarvis Cocker and have a personal guided tour of his exhibition. I'm Georgina Godwin. The Monocle Daily starts now. Hello and welcome to the Monocle Daily, coming to you live from our studios here at Midori House in London. I'm Georgina Godwin. It's Friday the 13th of May. Unlucky for some, but certainly auspicious for three shepherd children in Portugal back in 1917. We'll find out what happened on this day 105 years ago. Stay tuned. All that and more coming up right here on the Monocle Daily. This is the Monocle Daily and I'm Georgina Godwin. I'm joined first of all today by Marcus Hippie, who's in Warsaw. Marcus, you've been to the main train station there, which has been a hub for refugees from Ukraine. Is that still the case?
Hello, Georgina. Yes, it is still the case. I've been speaking to local people over here in Warsaw and they say that still every day that central station receives about 15,000 Ukrainian refugees. I went there just a moment ago to have a look at what's going on over there and The main central waiting hall has been converted into a welcome center for Ukrainian refugees, pretty much. So there's information desks over there, helping them with their travel plans, finding places to stay, and also with actually rather visible warnings of a chance of being exploited. Obviously, we have heard stories from the Ukrainian-Polish border, for example, that young women have been preyed over there and have been taken advantage of by human traffickers. So it was a very dramatic thing to see. Trains from Ukraine hadn't arrived for some hours, but there were visible, clearly some Ukrainians still left there. And maybe one of the most striking things I saw wasn't actually right at the station, but next to it. Well, Central Kitchen is a charity organization launched by Spanish-American chef Jose Andres, and that organization has been getting a bigger role in supporting refugees. And next to that central station here in Warsaw, there were two large tents full of people being served food and drink over there to help them continue with their journey. It was surrounded by Polish military officials, so it was hard to get much closer to see how many people exactly there were. No photos were obviously allowed to be taken either, but I would estimate that maybe about 500 people were inside those tents.
And Marcus, how do Poles feel about their visitors? Is there still a warm welcome?
It is very interesting. When I got here earlier today, I was expecting this whole situation to be more visible in Poland. I was expecting to see more Ukrainian flags. And I haven't seen many at all. And what Polish people are saying to me is that they are very proud of the way they've been welcoming Ukrainian refugees. We have to remember that Poland has so far received about 3.5 million Ukrainian refugees, which is much, much more than any other country. And they say that it's their responsibility to welcome these people. They feel that they're very proud with the way Poland has been dealing with that. But at the same time, I'm hearing a lot of criticism about what the government is doing at the moment, the populist government, which doesn't seem to be much. So the message I'm getting from many people is that individuals have been taking the responsibility of looking after these refugees, looking after these Ukrainians, and the government hasn't been doing that much at all.
Mm. Now, the news this week has been concentrating on Finland and Sweden joining NATO. Do you think that Poland and Finland will have a common approach to NATO?
I would imagine that that is something we'll find out eventually. It's interesting that you ask about that thing, considering that obviously, as we've been following on Monocle 24, Finland has been debating NATO membership for quite some time now, and there is a huge consensus in Finland that the country should join NATO as soon as possible. But at the same time, there are some academics and some commentators in Finland now who are saying that this whole thing has happened so quickly and it's gone forward so fast that Finland hasn't really stopped yet to think about what NATO membership would mean in the long run, what the liabilities would be and what it would mean for Finnish people in the long run. The focus very much is in an increasing Finnish security situation, that country being next to Russia in this situation. But increasingly many people at the moment seem to think that Finland should maybe also think about what NATO membership means in the long run and how that's actually going to work, which does not mean that there would be more people doubting the need for the membership, but it's just something that is good to keep in mind what it's going to mean in the future.
And Max, I understand you're not just in Warsaw to report on the political situation. You're also there on a culinary mission.
Yes, on a lighter note, that's actually the main reason why I'm here today. So that's another interesting thing. It seems that the Polish government is not doing awfully many good things at the moment. So the reason why I'm here at the moment is that a Polish food magazine that's called Food and Friends has decided to take the incentive to promote Polish food and develop the Polish culinary culture forward. So what they're doing today is to organize a big gala event where they've been inviting Polish food producers, food brands, and also international food experts. I guess I'm now counted as one of them as well. And the idea is to actually find out tonight what is good in Poland at the moment. They're trying to spread the message of what Polish food is and how good it can be. And they're also hoping to hear from people who are visiting Warsaw from abroad about our thoughts about what Poland could do and how Poland could develop its food culture. I think it's interesting that the editor-in-chief of that magazine, Food and Friends, was saying that his dream, his goal, is to make Poland the kind of a food destination Denmark is, for example, at the moment. And that's quite an ambition.
Absolutely. How do you make borscht sexy?
I'll see you more. Listen to the next episode of The Menu and you will find out.
Marcus, is Poland excited for Eurovision and have you found somewhere to watch it?
No, that's actually my plan for tomorrow. This day has been so busy with many chef interviews and trying to find out what's happening with the Ukrainian situation over here that I haven't actually had time to find a bar for Eurovision yet. But I'm glad to say that both Poland and Finland are going to be in the finals, and the UK obviously as well. So there are quite a few countries I can try to support this time round tomorrow evening.
Marcus, have a great time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, Warsaw's not the only place gearing up for the Eurovision final tomorrow night. Joining me now from Turin is Monocle 24 producer and Eurovision correspondent. I think we might even promote him to Eurovision desk chief, Fernando Augusto Pacheco. And here in the studio is Monocle magazine's culture editor, Chiara Ramella. And one of the reasons that you're here, Chiara, is not just because you're Italian. You're actually from Turin.
Yes, I'm the full package.
So what does hosting Eurovision mean for Italy and particularly for Turin?
I think that when Maneskin won last edition and I realised that it would be in Italy, that the contest would take place in Italy, I just assumed it would be in Rome. And never would I have expected for it to come to Turin. In reality, Turin is well equipped to host it. We did host the Winter Olympics quite a long time ago now, in 2006. But we have huge kind of stadia to be able to accommodate plenty of visitors. And also, I think Turin is a really interesting city music-wise. In the 90s and noughties, it kind of created a lot of the indie bands that went on to become some of Italy's most respected acts today. And I'm just really, really excited. My only true kind of sadness at this moment is that I can't really be there. But fortunately, one of our trusty Monocle team, the only person who could be there at this time, is there. And that fills my heart with joy.
Absolutely. Fernando, you fill our hearts with joy. And I'm sure being there for you fills yours with joy. Tell us about the atmosphere in Turin today.
Well, first of all, I have to thank very much Chiara. She gave me some lovely tips about the city. And I have to say, you know, The characteristics of Turin are the same of Chiara in a way. Elegant, understated, there's a certain coolness about the city that I love. It's very genteel as well. Yes, it's true.
Fernando, you flatter me too much.
But does it have the froth necessary for Eurovision?
But it's perfect. I think perhaps if he was in Rome, it would be a little bit too obvious. And it's funny, there are a lot of tourists in town, it's not in an overwhelming way. So, for example, after I finished work, I had a little kind of glass of wine before. I'm talking to you, Georgina, as always. But it was not overly crowded. It was not confusing. It was just very pleasant. I think the public transport was working, and that was not the case. You know, it's my 7th Eurovision. So there's some cities, there were quite a lot of problems in terms of tourists, in terms of kind of how to reach stadiums. I didn't encounter these problems here in Turin.
Well, Chiara and I knew that you might be having a little glass of wine, and we didn't want you to feel like you were drinking alone. So are we.
Definitely.
I'm very good. I think this is very important. I think when you're in Italy, to enjoy the music as well. But guys, I have to say, this Eurovision this year is proving to be kind of a vintage year. I think there are a lot of good tracks going on, and you know, it's quite exciting in a way.
Tell us about last night's semi-final, because you were there, obviously.
It was a very strong one. There were 18 countries competing overall. Only 10 go through. A few surprises, I have to say. For example, Belgium did go through. I was not the biggest fan, and the stadium was not a big fan as well. But you know, it's interesting. I think the people in the stadium, they like the more dance tracks, and I think people at home, they do enjoy a good ballad. But for a ballad to work in the stadium, it needs to be very good. And I think, for example, the Polish entry, I think he's doing very well in the polls and everything. He's got an amazing voice, and it's fine. I'm not really a ballad person, but I think his song really worked. Belgian, a little bit flat for me, but you know, I'm sorry for Belgians listeners. I do love Belgium, the country, and I do like Fritz, so sorry for that.
Chiara, have you been watching?
Well, I have to say that my biggest disappointment from last night was probably the fact that Achille Lauro, who is an Italian singer but who was representing San Marino, didn't make it through. He's extraordinary, really, this kind of really flamboyant character who's shaken up the kind of gender roles of very Catholic Italy. He's been on the Italian pop scene for quite some years now. He's always got these very provocative songs. He dresses very kind of androgynously, mishmash of different influences and different kind of fashion styles. Really, really kind of a character. And he had a song called Stripper last night to give you a bit of a gist of what he's up to. And unfortunately, he didn't make it through. I don't understand. If there was a stage for him, surely that should have been Eurovision. Maybe for once, Italy's kind of Catholic mores have proved more advanced than the Eurovision stage. I can't believe that. Faye, what do you reckon of Achille's performance last night?
His performance was amazing. I mean, the stadium was kind of dancing all around. There was even a gay kiss. It was quite provocative in a way. And then he was on top of this mechanical bowl, and he was wearing kind of, I don't even know, kind of a body kind of wear in a way. I think he was amazing. I have a feeling that he didn't go through because of the jury vote. We're only going to find out late on Sunday if that was the case. Because sometimes, you know, I think the public liked the track. I see no reason why they wouldn't. But maybe the jury, they perhaps can be a little bit more conservative and they just look at the voice, and perhaps the staging was a bit too much for some people. But, you know, it was definitely one of my favorites. And I think he made big news here in Italy because, yes, as Chiara was saying, he's Italian representing San Marino. But I see a lot of stories on La Repubblica. I think the media was really kind of surprised by that as well here.
Fernando, half of what Eurovision is about, I mean, if you're actually there in the venue, is about the Euro clubs. Tell us about the nightlife surrounding the competition.
Oh, yes. I mean, there's always the Euro clubs. And this year is a funny one because Turin decided for the first time there will be like 10 Euro clubs. They're not necessarily clubs. But there's been a little bit of criticism because, you know, some of my friends who were here as well, they went there and they were playing reggaeton. So it's even though they are Euro clubs, they're not really playing Eurovision music. So you have to be careful where you go in those 10 places. But don't worry, my recommendation, if you are in Turin, if there are any listeners, perhaps I shouldn't say that because the queue would be quite long for me, actually, in the end. But it's Hiroshima Mon Amour, which I think Chiara knows this club, has been quite a traditional place. Here in Turin, they are playing Eurovision nights for the whole week. I was there on Wednesday. What a delight. Even some of the Eurovision contestants this year were there, including the Lithuanian one, Monika Liu, which I quite like. Very understated, but a great track. But that's my tip if you want a good night out here in Turin and Eurovision as well.
Chiara, I wonder what nightlife's like when Eurovision isn't in town.
Oh, Turin's great for nightlife. I mean, Hiroshima Muramura, as Faye said, is a club in the south part of the city, quite isolated, but where I've spent plenty of a teenage night. The whole bank along the river, called the Murazzi, has a bunch of clubs that are open until the wee hours. They were shut quite controversially for many, many years, and then they finally kind of trying to take their new steps out into the nightclub scene. But it's a place of where electronic music was huge in the noughties. We know how to have a party. We may be genteel, but we know when to, you know, put our hair down.
Fernando, of course, the big deal is tomorrow night. It's the live show, and it's going to be fabulous. And it's presented, well, one of the presenters is Alessandro Catalan. I believe you've been speaking to her.
Yes, to him, Alessandro Catalan, he was a great guy. And I have to be honest, Georgina, I didn't know him very much before Eurovision. But then I was talking to some of my Italian colleagues, including Chiara. He's a big deal in Italy. I mean, he was has a long career. He was working at MTV in Italy at a program, Total Request Live, TRL. He was at the X Factor Italia for a decade. He's really very much a household name and super friendly. I think we bonded in a way. His wife is Brazilian, so he speaks a bit of Portuguese. He was a super fantastic guy. He's got a new series on Netflix where he interviews very iconic people like director Paolo Sorrentino. It's almost like a therapy session. So it's kind of an unusual interview show. He's a man of many talents. We had a very nice chat, which I think we have a little clip to play, right?
I used to be host for MTV. So I'm used to musical festivals and contests and big stages. And then I've been hosting the X Factor Italia for 10 years. So another song contest, but this is, of course, the biggest thing I've ever done in terms of viewers. And then I'm a need to host in English, which, yes, I can speak, but speak English in front of 2 million viewers, it's something that make like your leg shake. 200 million viewers.
You have good company with Laura Pausini and Mika as well, I think. Have you met them already? Have you discussed how is it going to work?
Yeah, we are a good team. We are a good team. I think we are balanced. Each one of us has his own personality, but we share the same spirit, I have to say, because we are three people who really love enjoying the moment. And that's what we are trying to do right now in Torino.
Yeah, I was talking, you know, we have a few Italians here in the office, and everybody was like, they remember your time at TRL. You had this strong
he's
presence.
He's still alive.
Yes.
He's still alive. Oh my.
And he's going host to the biggest show ever. What's the relationship between Italians and Eurovision, Alessandro? Because I know Italy was out of Eurovision for a while, but now it's back in style, right?
Yeah, I don't know who we have to thank for that. But also in Italy, Eurovision, it's huge again after a period when I think they didn't even broadcast the show. But Eurovision, I think, got back in the last 5, 6, 7 years, maybe more actually. And now it's a big deal in Italy. I think from 2011, it's a really big thing. It's a huge thing once again in Italy.
So that was Alessandro Catalan speaking to Fernando, and Alessandro is one of the presenters on the show. But there, as Fernando mentioned, a couple of others.
Definitely. Yeah. Well, Laura Pausini, perhaps the most memorable to me, because she's this huge superstar who is kind of part of the Italian kind of imagination, but also a huge superstar in Latin America. Mika, who, you know, Lebanese born, but huge in Italy because he was a judge on X Factor also. So, you know, very popular in Italy also. But I want to pick up on a point that Alessandra was making in that clip, which is this thing that obviously Eurovision wasn't very popular in Italy at all, because it wasn't broadcast on Rai for years and years and years. It only came back. So from 1998 to 2011, it didn't broadcast at all. So I didn't grow up with it. I didn't even know what it was. And I only came to love it when I moved to the UK. now that we've had a couple of quite successful runs at it, then suddenly everyone's really on the bandwagon. But I have to say, I can see my friends and family in Turin have really embraced Eurovision. You know, whether they were pre-existing fans or not, you know, my friend's gone to the first semi-final, my auntie's gone to the second semi-final, my mum, my six-year-old mum, has gone to the Euro Club during the day to listen to the music and go to the festival. People are really excited. I saw a video of Mahmoud and Blanco, who are the Italian entry, who are huge in Italy, like enormous superstars, just going down the street on a little like scooter, and all the Italian fans like flooding into the street to try and, you know, say hello. So I think it's really joyous, and it's great that Italy is moving out of its kind of more insular perspective on Italian music and just embracing Europe this way.
Absolutely. Fernando, are you beyond excited for tomorrow night?
I'm beyond excited. I mean, it's going to be, and you know what I'm excited for as well? You know, Chiara was talking about Italy and its relationship with Eurovision. Let's be honest here. I think Måneskin played a huge part on that. And they are everywhere. I mean, you put the radio on, they are there. If you're watching an ads on television, they are the soundtrack of it. And I think tomorrow they will be performing their new single, Supermodel, which I'm quite curious. And they became huge success. So I think Eurovision changed as well in the last decade, that the songs are not just, oh, that funny track on Eurovision. No, it's big business. Måneskin managed to chart even in the United States, which is quite rare for an Eurovision song to do that. So in a way, I think Eurovision is becoming more and more of a big business than ever, in a way.
Fernando, have a wonderful time when you're there live. Chiara, where will you watch it?
Well, I've actually been invited to another very exclusive Eurovision watch party, which is by former Monocle staffer Chris Chilvers, who's another enthusiast and fanatic. So we will be dedicated watchers, and there might be drinks.
Fernando and Chiara, thank you both very much. Eurovision can be loosely divided into good pop and bad pop, which coincidentally and happily is the title of a new book and exhibition by Jarvis Cocker, the former Pulp frontman. Well, our Sophie Monaghan-Coombs went to meet him, and she joins me in the studio now. What's he like, Sophie?
Well, as you said, I went to interview him today because I just realised that this exhibition that's to do with his new book is happening right around the corner. So I sort of just arrived and asked if I could speak to him, and he was very accommodating, which was quite a nice surprise. And I think there's a real kind of, I don't know, although he does a lot of broadcasting and speaking, and he's obviously been mining his own emotions and his own life through his music for decades. He's very earnest and, you know, very open and very incredibly kind of sort of happy to talk about quite, you know, deeply personal things and deeply personal things about his family and his upbringing.
And of course, he's brought all this together. He's not just a musician. He's brought it together as a memoir, as a book, but also as this exhibition that you can actually see all these objects that he's collected through his life. Tell us a little bit about the book.
So the book is his memoir. And rather than kind of coming at it from this sort of, you know, the crazy, wild music scene of the 90s, he kind of goes through the loft of a house that he used to live in, and he finds all these objects, and some of them are of kind of great importance and, like, obviously very significant. Some of them are very strange and, like, odd little toys or old sweets and things like that. And he's, you know, some of them he was like, I don't even know what this is. And so he kind of weaves them together to create this memoir that's more of a look into his childhood and his upbringing in Sheffield and how that shaped him and how it shaped his music and his life, rather than a kind of, yeah, expose of the kind of wild times of the 90s. So it's quite a unique project.
And then he gave you a private guided tour of his exhibition.
Yeah, so the exhibition is amazing. It has so many of these artefacts. As I said, there's, you know, some real kind of weird and wonderful stuff in there. There's also a recreation of his childhood bedroom and instruments that visitors are invited to kind of play as well. So we walked around it, and he talked to me about some of them. Some of my personal highlights included this tiny, tiny piece, a nub of a piece of soap that had, you know, no real story or anything behind it. It was just one of the things he found in the loft and decided to include in the memoir and the exhibition. So there's things like that. There's also things like kind of early plans for Pulp and how he was planning for it to take over the world and things like that. So I think we're going to hear a clip of him walking me around the exhibition and talking through some of the objects.
We're looking at a vitrine here, and it's got a shirt in the middle of it with it's orange with circles on it. So this is significant to me because that's the very first second-hand clothing item that I ever bought. So that was from a jumble sale just up the road from where I lived in Sheffield. So people who know anything about me, I suppose, will know that I tend to wear. People call it vintage now, but in my day it was secondhand, which was the beginning. It was an important thing for me because it was in the wake of punk rock happening. I decided I wanted to be in a band. I decided I wanted to do something different, and so choosing my own clothes was an important part of that. And I was just very lucky because this church was very near our house and jumble sales were very cheap. You know, that shirt would have cost 5 pence probably, so it was really an easy way to experiment with clothes. You could go and spend 50p and have a whole new wardrobe and just see what things you liked and which you didn't, and maybe throw away the ones you didn't, and start to learn about clothes that way. Another object right next to that shirt is this fantastic Dirty Joke book. So this I discovered on the back seat of a bus after we'd been to the swimming baths at school. And as you can imagine, I was around 13 at the time, so there was a massive fight for it amongst all the boys, and the back cover got ripped off. Somehow I got to take it home. And in the book I talk about how this book was, it was at a time when I was just about going through puberty, so I was looking for clues about what sex was about. I lived in a household which was very female dominated. My father had left when I was 7. There were no kind of men around. So I was desperate to find out about what sex was like from a man's perspective. I thought I would learn something from this book, but it's just really rubbish and all the jokes are really bad, and I didn't learn that much at all. We're now looking at one of the objects that really convinced me that rather than just clear the loft and put it all in a skip and get it out of my life so I had some space, when I found this object, I thought, oh no, it would be better to go through it and see if there are important things here. So this is like an exercise book which I wrote in, I guess, when I was about 14 or 15, and it's got a Pulp master plan, kind of like a manifesto of what the group is going to be. But it starts off with this, the Pulp illustrated wardrobe, which is a guide to what the group is going to wear. So we've got duffel coats. I mean, straight away, a duffel coat is really not a practical thing to wear on stage because you'd just be miles too hot. But I think it was more just a general look that you would wear all the time, you know. So duffel coat, crew neck jumpers, garish t-shirts, plain shirts, rancid ties, drainpipe trousers, Oxfam or paper jacket. I don't know what that doesn't make any kind of sense. Cheapo white baseball boots, silly socks, hair shortish, sequin being used for a silly purpose.
Sophie Monaghan-Coombs, thank you for joining us. And finally tonight, it's time for our regular feature on this day. Well, of course, the day today is Friday the 13th, so quite auspicious all the way around. This week, Monocle's Andrew Muller looks back to 1917 and the Our Lady of Fatima apparition. Here he is.
When one considers the list of Marian apparitions, purported manifestations in this realm, that is, of the Virgin Mary, it is not necessary to be an especially flint-hearted sceptic to detect that there is something of a pattern to them. These blessed events never occur, for example, in Times Square on New Year's Eve or the Shibuya Crossing at rush hour. Mary tends to show up in front of smallish audiences of picturesque yokels in locations which might otherwise possess little allure for tourists. Knock in County Mayo, Ireland, Medjugorje in southwestern Bosnia-Herzegovina, Lourdes in the French Pyrenees, and arguably most famously of all, on May 13th, 1917, Fatima in rural Portugal. The three illiterate shepherd children who saw Mary in Fatima, Lucia dos Santos, her cousins Francisco and Jacinta Marto, none older than 10, had an amount of form for this kind of thing. They had reported encountering the guardian angel of Portugal the previous year, but that claim had not acquired much traction. The Virgin Mary's appearance in Fatima on this day 105 years ago was, however, a sensation. And it gathered momentum as the blessed urchins were granted 5 further audiences over ensuing months, had 3 secrets revealed to them, and were promised a miracle, scheduled for October 13th. A hefty crowd pitched up on the appointed date, and indeed many later reported seeing the sun cavorting across the heavens in an unusual fashion, though this may have been a result of staring rather too long at it, as opposed to any divine intervention. The 3 secrets of Fatima were revealed in due course, 2 by Lucia in 1941, the 3rd by Pope John Paul II in 2000. The first was a description of hell, and it wasn't much you couldn't have guessed. Fire, demons, shrieking, etc. The second was a prediction that World War I would end and World War II would start, though this might have been more impressive if not published after both events had already come to pass. Considerable speculation therefore attended the contents of the third secret. Indeed, in 1981, one excitable former Fatima tour guide hijacked an Aer Lingus flight from Dublin to Heathrow. Among his demands was the publication of secret number 3. When it came, it was a bit of a bust. The then prefect of the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, later Pope Benedict XVI, tried gamely to pitch it as a prophecy of the attempted assassination in 1981 of John Paul II, another event which had already occurred, but somewhat glumly acknowledged that
no great mystery is revealed, nor is the future unveiled. A careful reading of the text will probably prove disappointing or surprising after all the speculation it has stirred.
A role as divine messengers bestowed no noticeable earthly rewards upon 2 of the Fatima 3. Francisco and Jacinta both died of influenza within a few years of meeting Mary, aged 10 and 9 respectively, as also predicted by Lucia, also some years after it occurred. Lucia became a nun and a prolific memoirist, publishing 6 volumes of autobiography, and lived until she was 97. She is believed to be on the fast track to sainthood. The legend of the apparitions said to have begun descending on Fatima this day in 1917 has doubtless been a source of great comfort and strength to many. And fine, that's what faith is for, if one is that way inclined. What cannot be argued is the wonders it has done for Fatima. In the last pre-pandemic year of 2019, the town of 13,000 people welcomed 6.3 million visitors. For Monocle 24, I'm Andrew Muller.
And that's all for this edition of The Monocle Daily. A big thanks to my panellists today, Marcus Hippie, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Chiara Romella and Sophie Monaghan-Coombs. Today's show was produced by Chris Chermak and researched by Lillian Fawcett and Samson Mbogo. Our sound engineer was Steph Chungu. I'm Georgina Godwin here in London, and The Monocle Daily is back at the same time on Monday. I'll be with you tomorrow for Monocle on Saturday. Goodbye, and thanks for listening.